Ryan Hurljack was 6 years old, living in Kempville, Canada. He was in the first grade, going to Holy Cross. And it turned out that when it came to Lent, that season right before Easter, his teacher wanted to teach these first graders about finding their place in the world, finding a way to make a difference and to understand your responsibility. And so it was that she asked all of the students during the season of Lent, these 40 days before Easter, would you start saving money? Deny yourself something, save the money, and then I'm going to give you a list of things that you can buy to donate to children who are in need in Africa. And she started going through the list, reading off, you could do this, you could do that, you could do this, moving down through the list. And then she came to the end and said, but do you understand there are several million children, people who are dying because they don't have clean water? And for only $70, you can drill a water well in Africa. Well, boy, that hit Ryan. And when class was over, he went up to his teacher and said, for $70, you said, you can buy a water well so people don't have to die? They can have a water well in Africa? Yes. He said, I'm going to give that. So Ryan went home. He was a six-year-old boy and went home to his mom and dad and said, I want to drill a water well in Africa and I need you to give me $70. That's the best way to raise the money. I need $70, please. He just started begging him for the money. Well, he's 6 years old, and his mom and dad did not take him seriously. But he kept asking that day and the next and the next and the next. And finally, they said, okay, if you're that serious about it, we won't give you the money, but we will let you earn it. We'll let you earn it by doing additional chores. And they laid out a list of here's chores you can do and here's what we'll pay for it. And Ryan said, okay. The six-year-old kid, he takes the list, he goes to work, he starts doing these chores, he's washing windows, he's picking up sticks. I mean, in the end, he has to run the vacuum cleaner and he hates running the vacuum cleaner, but he does it. He is focused. He has found his one thing. He gives it his all. It takes about 4 months. 4 months, and he has earned $70. They wind up talking to some different people. They got to find an organization now. They were referred to WaterCan. It was a nonprofit organization in Canada that drills water wells in Africa. And they go to WaterCan and said, you know, this is what my teacher told me, and we have the $70. And they said, we hate to break the news to you, but your teacher's fact sheet was a little off. It takes $2,000 to drill a well. Now, you're 6 years old. You've just denied yourself for the last 4 months to get to the goal of $70, and they tell you it's $2,000. What Ryan said was, fine, I'll do more chores. He was determined. Did not break his spirit. I'll do more chores. But now his parents said, we don't have $2,000 for chores. And they're all trying to figure out, so what are we going to do? And the CEO of WaterCan is so impressed with this kid's tenacity, this commitment, that in the end, she writes an article in the newsletter about Ryan. Well, that inspires other members in the family. They start thinking, we could write letters to lots of people about what Ryan's doing. And with all that going on, the newspaper picked up the story. And they wrote a feature article about Ryan and what he was trying to do to raise money for his well. And with all that going on, he gets a call from the local Rotary Club. By now, he's 7 years old, starting the second grade. And he goes to Rotary, and there he gives his first speech ever. And after giving a speech at Rotary, well, the local TV station picks up the story. And as he keeps telling the story and going to schools and talking and sharing, more and more people start sending in $10 and $25, and people are sending in their money, and he keeps forwarding everything that comes in to WaterCan. And after 10 months, one day he gets a phone call and they say, you've reached your $2,000. The question now is, where do you want to drill the well? And so he comes in and sits down, and they have their representative from Uganda, the one who is there to oversee them, and he begins to tell Ryan about this little town, Angolo. It's a village of 5,000 people. And in Angolo, they don't have any water. Children can't go to school because they have to spend their day walking miles to get water and bring it back and do it repeatedly. But the water they go get is in this muddy pit, and quite often it is soured, and people drink this water, and quite often they get sick. But it's the only water they have. And Ryan says, that's where I want to drill the well. And so it was in 1999, they drilled a well. And when all the neighbors saw how Ryan, for over a year, had been so focused, so committed to this one thing, they were all moved. And the people in his town, they began to donate all their airline miles until finally they had enough so that Ryan and his mom and dad could fly for free to Angolo, Uganda, and go see the well. And so it was that Ryan made this trip when he was 7. And when he came to Angolo, there was 5,000 people that lined this dirt road. And they were there dressed in their finest, and they're all singing and chanting. And this little 7-year-old boy walks down the street, looking at these people and smiling. They lead him all the way up to where the well is in this village. And there's the concrete base poured, and on the bottom it is written in the concrete, Ryan's Well, Angolo. And they ask him to pump the handle, and he pumps the handle, and he kneels down and he begins to drink the fresh water. And the man who is in charge of the village says, you are now everyone's son and brother. You are a part of us, for you have brought life. 7-year-old Ryan had found his one thing. This morning, I want to conclude this sermon series, The One Thing. And what I've been hoping you would do during this series is take seriously to be looking at your life and thinking about what matters. You know, you and I have so many things that pull at us. So many things that are calling for our time, our attention. It's easy to do so many different things. And we've learned the idea that if you try to be perfect at everything, you are not excellent at anything. Not everything is of the same value. Not everything is equal on your to-do list. What matters? What's the one thing? And I've simply been hoping that all of us would be taking the time to do the hard work of really thinking about what are those areas in our life that matter. They're not all the same. Your relationship with God, your relationships with people, how you give your time, you spend your passion. What's your passion? What gives your life significance? I just wanted us to think about it and decide these are the things that really matter. And once we have the global set, then you're able to look at each day. What's the one thing I need to do today that moves me towards the goal of the things that matter? Because not everything in a day's time is of equal importance. What's the one thing that really does matter? For Ryan, it became clean water. And people would say to him, you know, you're a kid. Don't you miss just playing and being a kid? And his response was, I love playing, but I love thinking about clean water. And I kind of do both of these, and that's what gives my life meaning. It's my passion. What's your one thing? I thought about our scripture lesson this morning. I think this is one of the most poignant stories in the New Testament. Jesus fixing breakfast on the beach, preparing the fire, cooking breakfast for Peter and the disciples. You remember the backstory. Peter had answered Jesus' call, left being a fisherman in order to follow Jesus for 3 years, learning all about what Jesus had to say. And then they go to Jerusalem. And when they get to Jerusalem, Jesus says, someone's going to deny me, betray me, and you will all deny me. And Peter, in all of his bravado, speaks up and says, everybody else may run away, but it's not going to be me. I will go to the death for you. And Jesus is betrayed, and everybody runs away. Peter follows behind and gets into the courtyard, and there one of the maids says, you were with him, weren't you? And Peter's never seen him before. Don't know him. And the cock crows, and Peter runs into the night. Jesus dies. But 3 days later, he's raised from the dead. Peter and John feel like they encounter the presence of the risen Christ, but it is also confusing. Peter goes fishing with some of the disciples. They'd fished all night long and caught nothing. And then when the dawn's first light comes, one of the disciples looks on the beach and sees a fire going and suddenly says, it's the Lord. They bring the boat to shore, and there Jesus is cooking breakfast. And now Peter has to come and sit and confront the risen Christ. He is there looking right into Jesus' eyes. Can you imagine how painful that was? And then Jesus says, Peter, do you love me? Peter, am I the one thing, the most important thing to you? Peter, do you love me? I believe that question that Jesus asked Peter is the question that Jesus asked all of us. Do you love me? Am I the one thing, the thing that's most important to you? Because if you say yes, well, then it affects the way you do the things you do. It's going to affect your one thing. It will change everything if that answer for you is yes. Because Peter says, Lord, you know that I love you. And then he gets what he knew would be coming. Then go feed my sheep. You love God? Well, then I'm asking you to go out and love others. To live in a spirit of compassion and kindness and goodness and respect. To do your thing a new way. What's your one thing? Jesus would ask, do you love me? That's what I want us to think about this morning as we conclude this series. And I really want to leave you with just three thoughts. First of all, I really do hope you and I'll take seriously the work of asking ourselves the question, what's my one thing? And then listening with our hearts. That isn't easy. We like to just kind of go on. It is difficult work to say, I'm taking this seriously, to be asking myself the question and then listening with our hearts. What does God have to say to us? I think about Peter and how it was so confusing and he had failed and it had been so difficult. And I love it in the story how it says, and he went fishing and they fished at night and they caught nothing. If you go fishing all night and you're not catching anything, you got a lot of time to think. And that's what Peter was doing. All night long, he was thinking, listening to his heart. How did he feel about Jesus? How did he feel about his own failure? How did he feel about his calling? And that's why in the morning when one of the disciples says, it's the Lord, it says Peter sprang into the water and swam to shore. He didn't wait for them to row the boat to shore. No, he'd been thinking. He knew his heart. It's the Lord. I mean, he hits the water and he is there first because he knew his heart. Are you listening? Rod Wilmoth was a good friend of mine. Neat guy, United Methodist minister, pastor for many years at Hennepin United Methodist Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Rod is now in the kingdom of heaven. But I always remember his wonderful sense of humor. And he tells about how when he was growing up, he was a part of a fraternity in college. And when he graduated, he loved his fraternity, stayed involved on a national level. Turned out that he would one day become chaplain of his national fraternity. And then he'd keep on moving up and serving. And finally, later on in years, he'd be elected president of his national fraternity organization. And the thing he loved the most, he said, was every year they'd have a convention and they would invite 400 of the students from the different chapters all around the United States, the best and the brightest, to come together. They would study leadership and they'd talk as an organization, what are the good things we're going to do. And he said he loved being with these smart and committed and insightful students. Well, the year that he was president, the convention was in Cincinnati, Ohio. And they had all their leadership planning going on, but one night they decided to take a break and go to the Cincinnati Reds baseball game. And so they bought their block of 400 tickets. And when the Reds saw that, they then called the organization and said, "You have bought 400 tickets. You get to decide who's going to sing the national anthem and who's going to throw out the first pitch." Well, they immediately said, "We got a glee club. They'll sing the national anthem. But we want our president, Rod Wilmoth, to throw out the first pitch." And Rod said he was so excited. I mean, how cool was that? You're going to get to walk out on the Cincinnati Reds field and throw that first pitch. And the more he thought about it, the more afraid he became. The more anxious and the more scared, he started thinking about how many of those first pitches you see on ESPN when somebody throws and it hits first base instead of the catcher. Yeah, he started feeling a little anxious and afraid. And so on the night of the game, he was down there behind the dugout where he was supposed to meet the representative from the Reds. And he was looking out. And he said, "You know, when you get down at field level, that field looks bigger than on TV." And he said, "I started looking, how far is it from the pitcher's mound to the catcher? I mean, that's a long way." And he was looking at it when this lady comes up and says, "We're so great to have you, Rod. This is going to be special. Now, I just need to tell you, it's really a lot further from the pitcher's mound to home plate than it looks on TV. When was the last time you threw a baseball? 30 years ago?" She said, "You know, you may want to walk to halfway between the mound and home plate in order to throw out that first pitch." I could do that? "Sure, sure, you can do that. Just walk halfway and throw out the pitch." And Rod said, "Man, I'm starting to feel a little bit better. Okay, okay." So he walked over to the gate where the guard was standing at the gate where he'd walk out. And he walked up to the gate and the guard said, "You know, it's a lot further from that mound to home plate than it looks on TV." And Rod said, "You know, I know that, but the lady told me I could walk halfway out there and make the pitch." And this guy cracks up laughing and says, "Well, yes, yes, you can. If you want 30,000 people to laugh at you." And just at that moment, the loudspeaker came on, "Reverend Rod Wilmoth to throw out the first pitch." And they open the gate. And he starts walking out onto the field. And suddenly he hears 400 voices chanting, "Rod, Rod, Rod." And he thought, "Rod." He said, I can't just go halfway. I got to do what they expect. I got to try to do what's right." He sucked it up and walked over to the umpire and said, "Give me the ball." He walked out onto the mound. He did his windup and he threw a strike. When he got back home to his church at Hennepin with his family of faith, he said, "In the midst of all the noise and the chaos, do you hear the one who's calling your name? The one who promises to be there with you, to help you and lead you, today and forever. Are you listening? To do the work. To ask the question, what's my one thing? To hear Jesus say, do you love me? Secondly, if you and I do the hard work and we are willing to ask the question and to listen with our hearts, I think you'll discover you have the courage to confront your fears and act. Do the one thing. It's not about just thinking the one thing. It's about doing the one thing. It's about acting. And that's always difficult because we become afraid. Can you imagine how Peter felt when he goes and he's sitting by the fire and Jesus says, Peter, do you love me? Now, Peter had been with Jesus for 3 years. He knew what he was about and what he'd be teaching, and he could see what was coming. If you say, you know that I love you, Lord, Jesus is going to say, then go and do it again. It means that Peter failed. He knows the pain of failing, and he's going to be asked to go out and try and do it again. He knows that with all the bravado, he still didn't do it. And now, Peter, I'm going to ask you to get out there and risk yourself and try and maybe fail again. Peter, do you love me? You know that I love you, Lord. Then go feed my sheep. We're afraid of not being good enough, of being inadequate, of failing. I believe that courage is not an absence of fear. Courage is when you say yes to life in spite of your fears. You will always have fears. When you risk and try and stretch, it's going to make your heart race and the adrenaline pump. You don't ever get past your fears. Courage is saying yes to life in spite of your fears. I'm still going to risk myself and step out there and go. Go feed my sheep. I was talking with a young mom in our church last week. She had her kids and they were getting ready to go out and see Disney on Ice. And we were talking about these ice skaters And you know, ice skating is amazing. It got me to thinking about when I go up to Colorado with the grandkids, sometimes I'll go ice skating with them because they want to ice skate. And when I say I go ice skating, it means I hold on to the rail and move my feet forward kind of along the outside of the rail. You know, you see all these people, they go going backwards and they glide and they jump and they twist. That's tough. Ice skating takes incredible skill. And when you watch something like Disney on Ice or you watch the Olympics, I mean, those people are amazing. What skill, training it takes. And we're talking about this and I'm thinking about it, and it made me think of one of my favorite stories by Arthur Gordon. How years ago he was a Cub reporter and the greatest show on ice was coming to town. And he would give him the assignment as a Cub reporter to go interview the star of the show, a young lady who was kind of the up-and-comer and just really had become a star, and to get her story for the newspaper. So he got with her before the show. He asked all the stock questions. Finally had one last question to ask, and that was simply, so how did you get started? And he said he could tell she just got quiet and looked at him, and he knew she was trying to decide, do I give him the stock pad answer real quick or do I tell him the truth? And he just stayed quiet, and she finally said, to answer that question, I have to tell you a story. And he said, I've got time if you do. Her name was Margaret, but everybody called her Maggie. When she was 8 years old, she said she had big round eyes and big glasses. She had braces on her teeth. She had knobby knees and skinny legs. She said she was about as coordinated as a newborn colt. And to make matters worse, she had an older sister. Her name was Sybil. Sybil was 16, and she was beautiful. She was so coordinated. She was a cheerleader. She was so popular. And then one day, Sybil got a date with Larry. Now, Larry was the quarterback on the football team. He was a good-looking guy, outgoing. Everybody wanted a date with Larry, and Sybil had it. And she came home. She was so excited that next Saturday they were going ice skating out on the pond there in town. And she was thrilled to have this date with Larry. And Sybil's mom spoke up and said, "I think that is great. I really would like you to take Maggie along so she could have fun too." Now, you're 16 years old, and you have a date with the man on campus everybody wants, and your mom says, "Take your 8-year-old sister." She went crazy. She went berserk, hollering, screaming, "Absolutely not, I won't do it." And her mother was very calm, and finally she took a breath and said, "If Maggie doesn't go, you don't go." When Larry showed up on Saturday, he was picking up two girls. And they walked out to the car, and Sybil opened the back door to make sure Maggie understood where she went. She got in the front then, and they all took off to the lake. When they arrived, so many kids were already there out ice skating, and they had the hot chocolate flowing, and hamburgers were cooking. And Larry went over and knelt down and put on Sybil's skates and laced them up. And then he said, "Maggie, can I lace up your skates?" "No, no, I just want to sit here." "Okay." And so he took Sybil's arm, and the two of them skated off. Maggie just laid back in the snow. She felt so alone. So alone, she hurt. She felt unlovable. She was lying there for a while, and apparently Larry must have been watching, because all of a sudden he skated back up. And he reached down and grabbed her skates and took her by the hand and said, "Come on." "Oh, no, no, no. I don't know how to skate." "Come on." "Sybil, well, don't worry about Sybil. Come on." They went around a point into kind of a more private cove. And there he knelt down and he put on her skates and began to lace them up. And she said, "Don't you understand? I don't know how to skate. I don't know how to skate." And he said, "I know. I'm going to teach you." He took her by the hand. She stood up and tears are streaming down her cheek. She said, "I don't know how to do this. I'm afraid. Don't you understand? I'm afraid." And Larry stepped back and said, "I know. I know, because I used to be just like you. People don't know it. I used to feel so alone, and I was so afraid." Funny, I can't tell Sybil this. I don't tell most people this, but I can tell you, I was so afraid until I discovered there is one. There is one who is always with you. There is one who cares for you. You don't have to be afraid. And Maggie, what I'm telling you is, He is with you. You don't have to be afraid. You can try. Now put your arm around my waist. Now push off with your right foot. And now your left. And now your right. Took only a couple minutes to tell the story. Suddenly all the lights went down. And then there was a whirling kaleidoscope of color and sound. And the lights came up and Maggie skated out to the center of the rink, star of the show. Arthur simply moved down the rail, all the way down to where Maggie's husband was standing. He never took his eyes off her to look at Arthur, but he simply said to Arthur, "She is so special, isn't she?" And Arthur said, "You both are, Larry. You both are." To understand, you don't have to be afraid. There is the one who is with you. It means you have to try. Jesus was on the beach. And here Peter comes. And I believe it was supposed to be a message to Peter. if you say you love me and I tell you to go feed my sheep, do you understand? I'm going to be there. Just like this morning when I have come to fix breakfast on the beach, I will be there. Do you love me? Then you go try again. Go feed my sheep. I believe it's God's grace that gives us the courage to say yes to life and confront our fears. And so third, I just leave you with the thought of stay focused. Stay focused on your one thing. You know, we think it's hard for children to focus. I think it's awfully hard for adults to stay focused. In our world today, there's so many things pulling at us. You know, they've shown people who are sitting working on a computer. You know, you got your computer and you got all these apps that are open. You got your phone, you got your iPad. They say that there are so many things coming at you that typically you will change programs, change your apps 38 times an hour. So much is coming at you. Well, on the big scale, do you stay focused on the thing that matters? And it's going to be different for all of us. That's what's important. It's different for you and me. I think of how Peter walked along the beach and Jesus said, come, follow me. You've been a fisherman? I'm asking you to be a fisher of men. What he did and how he lived changed completely. But when Jesus came to Zacchaeus, who was a tax collector, he didn't ask him to follow him in the same way as stop being a tax collector. He just simply said, if you love me, Zacchaeus, then the way you are a tax collector will change. You will be compassionate and kind and loving and fair. If that's your thing, great. How you do your thing changes. And after Peter decides to follow Jesus, he would ultimately confront Cornelius, who was a Roman soldier and a Gentile, and Peter learned that lesson. He did not ask Cornelius to convert and be a Jew or to stop being a Roman soldier. He simply said, as that person you are you going to be compassionate and kind and faithful and true? What your one thing is for you and God to decide. What you do for significance, what you do to make your life matter, you get to decide. Stay focused. For Ryan Hurljack, what a fascinating young man. 6 years old, he decides it's clean water. That's what he wants to wind up doing. I told you how here he raised this $2,000. He travels to Angolo, Uganda. And when the chief stands up and says, do you understand of these 5,000 people, you are our son to all and our brother to all. We will never forget you. Because on July the 27th, forever, it's going to be Ryan's day. Every year, forever, the 27th is Ryan's day. And on that day, we will all go do something to try to help other people. Whatever was within our capability, we'll go help somebody else on Ryan's day. Oh man, that did something to his soul. And when Ryan comes back home, he doesn't start to go play now. No, he keeps on trying to raise money for clean water. And that's what he's been doing all the way to today. He's now 25 years old, stands 6'6". He's formed his own foundation years ago. It's now bigger than him, is what he likes to say. Through his foundation, they've now raised $6 million. They have drilled 1,000 water wells in 16 different countries, providing clean water to over 1 million people. Because that's where he finds his passion, his significance. I watched an interview with him and I loved what he had to say. The world is like a great big puzzle, and we all have to figure out where our puzzle piece fits. I figure my piece fits with clean water. I just hope everyone else finds out where their puzzle piece fits too. What's your one thing? It's in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Let each of us lift up our own silent prayer.